Morning. First case on our docket is Lewis versus the people. We're ready to hear from the petitioner.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Sarah Virtus, registration number 39236, and I represent the petitioner, Mr. Burt Lewis, in this case. I would like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. We are here today because the district court found that the prosecutor had already raised a claim for relief in a probation revocation complaint, and so the court dismissed the second revocation complaint based on the doctrines of issue preclusion and claim preclusion. Mr. Lewis had pled guilty to possession of a controlled substance and was on probation for a year when the state filed its first complaint to revoke his probation on several grounds. Before that revocation hearing, the state amended the complaint to include an incident where Mr. Lewis had gone to Kansas without informing his probation officer and was arrested there for possession of methamphetamine. At the revocation hearing, the district court did not allow the prosecutor to proceed with the allegations of unlawful use of a controlled substance in Kansas because of a lack of notice to the defense. The district court offered to set a new hearing date for the Kansas violations, but the prosecutor declined. The revocation hearing went forward, and the district court found that Mr. Lewis had violated several conditions of his probation. At the subsequent sentencing hearing, the prosecutor again brought up the violations of law in Kansas. The district court allowed the prosecutor to discuss the Kansas violations over defense counsel's objection, and the court considered them in its decision to increase Mr. Lewis's sentence from 3 years of probation to 4 years of intensive supervised probation. More than a year later, the state filed a second complaint to revoke Mr. Lewis's probation, alleging that Mr. Lewis had been convicted of the violations of law in Kansas. After a hearing, the district court found that the issues arose out of the same act committed by Mr. Lewis in Kansas that had been raised in the first revocation. The court applied issue preclusion and claim preclusion to deny the state the ability to proceed on the second complaint. The Court of Appeals agreed that the four factors of the issue preclusion test were met. However, the court erroneously found that the burden of proof would have been higher for the state in the first revocation complaint. In the first revocation complaint, the state had alleged that Mr. Lewis violated the condition number 13, unlawful use of a controlled substance, when he unlawfully possessed methamphetamine. Proof of that violation would have been by a preponderance of the evidence, as the prosecutor herself noted in the motion to dismiss hearing. In the second complaint, the prosecutor was alleging a violation of law based on a conviction from the Kansas violations, and since Mr. Lewis had already been convicted at that point, that the second complaint was submitted, proof of that would have also been by a preponderance of the evidence. Therefore, the Court of Appeals was incorrect in its determination that the burden of proof would have been higher, and therefore that exception to issue preclusion should not apply in this case.
Ms. Burst, to support your argument, you believe that the holding in People versus Moses is correct, that it's dealing with the issue of revocation for a discretionary condition which happens to be an offense as opposed to the statutory condition that requires proof beyond a reasonable doubt?
I believe that is the law in this state. Whether that issue was properly decided by the Court of Appeals, I'm not entirely sure. I think that there is an argument, because both condition number 1 and condition number 13 are dealing with violations of law, essentially, unlawful use of a controlled substance or just straight violation of law for condition number 1. And
well,
it's,
give me just for a second.
Certainly.
Go ahead.
And so since they both deal with violations of law, there is certainly an argument that proof would have to be beyond a reasonable doubt to prove either of those violations. However, that's not what the Court of Appeals held, and I do believe that is the law as it stands.
Well, but what we're asking you is, what should the law be?
The law certainly could be that violation, that People versus Moses could be overruled, and violation of condition number 13 could be necessarily proven by proof beyond a reasonable doubt. If that were the case, and it were to be applied as such in this case, I think at the time, certainly proof for the prosecutor would have been by a preponderance, and that's why she charged it that way. But were this court to find that proof had been, in fact, by beyond a reasonable doubt, and thus was higher, I think claim preclusion still certainly applies in that case, in this case, excuse me. Okay, thank you. As I said, the Court of Appeals was correct in finding that the four factors of issue preclusion apply. The court also found that three of the factors of claim preclusion apply, but found that the subject matter, the second factor, that the subject matter must be identical, was not met because the nature of the claims was different. However, this court has noted that the test for whether the subject matter is identical in claim preclusion is can be either whether both proceedings involve the same underlying facts or whether they would have been proven by the same evidence. And here, the the same underlying facts were that the violations for both the first complaint and the second complaint were based on violations of law in Kansas, that Mr. Lewis had been there and had been arrested for unlawfully possessing methamphetamine.
If I understand it, however, the factual nature of the Kansas transaction is brought in the first time at sentencing, not as a basis for revocation. Is that correct?
Not entirely, Your Honor. It is raised. The prosecutor amended that first revocation complaint about a month before the revocation hearing to include allegations of the Kansas violations.
But the trial court didn't accept that, right?
The trial court did not let her proceed on it, but she never removed those violations from that initial complaint. So they were still on the complaint when Mr. Lewis's probation.
But it wasn't the basis for the revocation, or one of the basis.
It was not one of the basis.
Okay, so the second proceeding, the basis for the revocation is an actual conviction.
That's right. However, the conviction is solely the method of proof that would be used to prove the violation of probation based on condition number one, which states that there must have been that someone violates probation by violating the law. And the way that Mr. Lewis violated the law here was by unlawfully possessing the methamphetamine in Kansas. And so, although she stated that the violation was based on the conviction, that was her manner of proving that he violated the law in Kansas by possessing it.
Well, wasn't it a violation of probation to be over in Kansas in the first place, but that was not the basis for the revocation the first time? That just affected the sentence? The second revocation actually then occurs based on a conviction that's been entered? Aren't those the facts?
Those are essentially the facts, yes. But it's true that in the first revocation, the court did not revoke based on the violations of law in Kansas. It was on the other allegations of probation violations. But it was raised as part of that complaint. It had been amended and added to the complaint. And the court offered the prosecutor the opportunity to prove up those violations, and she declined. And she then again raised it at sentencing over defense counsel objection.
Well, I'm just trying to get at what was actually litigated the first time and the second time.
Okay, I see. What was actually litigated the first time were the other violations. That's correct. And that was the basis for his probation revocation.
Regardless of the reasons why probation was revoked, if I understand it right, it was revoked, and about 2 months later, he was resentenced and placed on ISP. Is that correct?
Yes.
Now, the allegations for the subsequent conviction concern a Kansas incident that precedes that resentencing by about a year. Is that not correct? In other words, it was about a year before he was placed on ISP that he committed the crimes in Kansas for which he was subsequently convicted.
That's correct.
I'm a little confused how we even reach this issue, in that I wonder if you could explain to me, or perhaps the district attorney will, how it is that his probation could be revoked for an incident which occurred prior to him being placed on probation.
I'm sorry. I think I misunderstood your question.
Well, let me just repeat.
Okay.
He was placed on probation on ISP after his revocation in September of 04, correct?
Right.
Then he was subsequently convicted, but the conviction is based on an incident in Kansas that precedes his placement on ISP by a year.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Yes, yes.
And so my question is, would it even be a violation of his probation that a year before he was placed on ISP probation, that he committed this crime? In other words, he committed the crime before his ISP period commenced.
Right, and that is correct. I don't think that issue has really been addressed by either the Court of Appeals or the District Court below. I believe that defense counsel, in his motion to dismiss, raised an issue about the timing of the second revocation complaint, that issue hasn't really been addressed. And there is certainly an argument, I agree, that one would be precluded if the violation occurred before the probation commenced.
Well, I think my point is I'm not so sure that it's preclusion, and I'm not quite sure why we're talking about preclusion, because my concern is whether that would even be a violation of probation since it happened 2 years before he was placed on probation.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I can actually give you a good answer to that. I just know that in both the trial court and and it appears in the Court of Appeals as well, it was conceived as a violation of his probation, since probation originally commenced in 2003. And that's sort of, I think, how most people were viewing this as a violation. But I agree that there is certainly an issue there, although I don't know that I can answer it any better than that. In this case, the same underlying facts and evidence would have been used for both probation revocations, because they were both based on the violations of law in Kansas. And therefore, the Court of Appeals was incorrect in finding that the subject matter was not identical. The subject matter was identical, as I said, and so the four factors of claim preclusion also apply. And
you don't think there's a difference between the facts that underlie the conviction and the conviction itself?
For the purposes of probation revocation and revoking probation based on a violation, I don't think that there is necessarily a distinction between the conviction and the underlying facts.
Why is that?
Because the violation of probation is stated as is alleged in the conditions of probation, the allegation is that Mr. Lewis violated his probation by violating the law for condition number 1, or by unlawful use of a controlled substance for condition number 13. And that's what the issue is whether or not he violated probation by violating the law in some fashion. And the conviction, I believe, is essentially just a method of proving that violation, and necessarily requires the court to find that, in fact, those underlying facts did occur. And therefore, I think it is based on the same underlying facts. Therefore, I think that the Court of Appeals did err. And I would ask that this court find that issue preclusion or claim preclusion or both apply in this case. And I would ask that the Court of Appeals decision be reversed. And I would reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court. I would first like to address Justice Martinez's concern.
Excuse me, could you please identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Jim Whitmire, attorney registration number 6182. I would like to address Justice Martinez's concern about the sequence of events here. Your Honor, my understanding is that Mr. Lewis was placed on probation October 16th, 2003, and the stop in Kansas where he was arrested was October 15th, 2003, so that occurred subsequent to his probation. He was already on probation when that happened.
Mr. Whitmire, I think Justice Martinez's point was that he was granted probation anew, although it was under the he was resentenced and given probation about a year later and put on ISP.
Correct.
And so this whole transaction in Kansas occurred before his probation was revoked, and he was resentenced to probation. So that's, I think, Justice Martinez's point, that all these events occurred before he was placed on ISP probation as a new sentence. So why would it be applying?
Well, that's correct. But the issue of whether or not he violated probation by committing an offense in Kansas was never litigated. And
it may not have been litigated, but certainly the court was fully aware of it.
I think, moreover, whether it was litigated or not, he isn't on that probation anymore. That probation was revoked. So why does it have to be litigated? I mean, what is the significance of whether he violated it, since his probation's already revoked and he is now on a different ISP period of probation?
The purpose of a probation revocation is for the court to supervise the probationer to make sure that the original sentence was the correct sentence. And he was revoked on other grounds, which are more technical. I would submit that the most serious revocation or violation a probationer could commit is committing another crime, especially where it's similar to the crime for which he is on probation. So revoking his probation, again, doesn't result in a conviction. It's merely for the purpose of the court to reassess the sentence and to determine if the sentence that he previously imposed is appropriate.
So is your point that he was only on probation for having committed an offense, and even though the terms of the probation were changed, he was put on ISP, it's still just one probation sentence?
Well, the probation was revoked and re-granted, but it's probation pursuant to his original conviction. And supervision is an ongoing process. And just because he's revoked doesn't mean the court is going to even impose a more serious sentence. If he had conducted himself appropriately during that period of time when he was put on the second probation, the court would take that into consideration at the new sentence hearing.
But after he was put on ISP, he didn't commit a new crime, or at least he wasn't convicted of it. That was before. And I think that's the point that we're trying to explore here.
Well, he didn't commit the crime after that, but he was convicted of it after that.
And why is that fair to take that into consideration? Or should the court just be looking at his conduct after he was placed on ISP?
Well, I think a conviction for possession of methamphetamine and anhydrous ammonia is serious enough that it should be brought to the attention of the sentencing court. Probation is a privilege, it's not a right. And as I indicated before, revoking his probation again is not a conviction. It's merely for the court to consider the appropriateness of the original sentence.
Mr. Whitmire, could I ask you, how is condition number one actually phrased? What is the condition that is violated here?
Well, condition number one is violation of the state law.
Okay. Good. And so it's not phrased in terms of the conviction. It's phrased in terms of a violation of the law?
Correct.
And so is your argument, if I can just pursue this, is your argument that any violation of a probation condition then, even though the defendant has had his probation revoked and been resentenced, any violation of his original probation conditions could be brought up in a second revocation of a new resentencing to probation?
Well, I think that's correct. If neither one of these doctrines that we're talking about, namely claim preclusion or issue preclusion, apply. And this issue of the violation of state law in Kansas was never litigated.
Quite apart from doctrines of you know, res judicata, collateral estoppel, whatever, quite apart from those doctrines, are you just saying, though, that it would be a permissible complaint for a probation revocation that somebody violated a condition of a previous probation, as long as it stemmed from the same conviction?
Well, if the revocation wasn't based on that previous act, especially if it's a criminal offense, I think that would be okay.
Is that only because it's a criminal offense? I mean, if he violated a curfew or something and that were not raised at his revocation, and so it wasn't either sustained or not sustained, could it be raised later after his...
I don't believe so. I think the doctrines would bar that. The reason I think there's an exception for a criminal offense, the probation revocation statute specifically provides that the probation revocation proceeding can be continued until after the defendant goes through the criminal proceeding. And this court has said, in People versus Carr, that's actually the preferred procedure.
But that didn't happen here, did it? It wasn't continued. He was revoked.
He was revoked on four other unrelated grounds. Driving under restraint, failing to report, I think, and some others.
Okay.
So, concerning issue preclusion, my contention is that it's really very simple. Unless the issue is litigated, then that doctrine doesn't bar subsequent litigation. And it's very clear to me, although this is in disagreement with what the Court of Appeals said, that issue was never litigated. The probation department and the prosecutor tried to raise the issue in the amended complaint. And it was done in what I think was a timely manner, but the defense attorney objected to proceeding on that. And then the judge agreed and would not allow the prosecutor to present that at the revocation hearing. The judge offered to set it at a later date, but the prosecutor declined because she had brought a witness from Kansas, and she didn't want to bring the witness back from Kansas. So I would contend that was an abandonment of that issue. There was never a ruling. For there to be a determination, there has to be an actual court ruling or order, either orally or written, and that was never done. And as far as claim preclusion, if there is no final judgment, that doctrine doesn't bar future litigation. And there was no future final judgment in this case. The one exception to the claim preclusion doctrine is that the claim could have been brought, then that would bar. But I would submit the statute overrides that. The statute allows the case to be continued until after the conclusion of the criminal proceeding. And again, this court has said in People versus Carr that that's the preferred method of doing it. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One, it eliminates the danger of abuses as a result of informality of the revocation hearing. And secondly, it eliminates any possibility of the defendant being forced to compromise his right to self-incrimination or against self-incrimination. So for those reasons, I don't think the doctrines, and those are the reasons we're here today, whether claim preclusion or issue preclusion, preclude the litigation of that issue, a violation of state law. And I don't believe either one of those doctrines preclude that litigation. And that's all I have, unless you have more.
Counsel, before you sit down here, do you take a position on the ground that the Court of Appeals actually rested its decision on, which is the differential burden in the two proceedings?
I'm sorry, would you restate that?
Yeah, do you take a position, what is your position on the actual ground that the Court of Appeals rested its decision on, which is the differential burden between the two proceedings?
That's the point I agree with the Court of Appeals on. The revocation statute itself makes it clear that if the allegation is violation of a criminal offense, then the burden is beyond a reasonable doubt. And all of the other allegations that could be made in a revocation is by a preponderance of the evidence. And I believe where the burden is greater in the first proceeding, then the doctrine doesn't apply.
Thank you.
Mr. Whitmer, is that consistent with the Moses case?
With the
doctrine
Moses,
you just...
With the Moses case?
Yes. Seems to me that the Moses case says it's preponderance.
Well, if the allegation was merely... If one of the terms and conditions was defendant shall not possess methamphetamine, if that's it, it would be by a preponderance. But if the allegation is that by possessing methamphetamine, it was a violation of state law, then it's beyond a reasonable doubt.
That's how you distinguish Moses, huh?
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I just want to address two points. One, opposing counsel mentioned that the point of the revocation and the need to bring these types of complaints is to bring it to the attention of the sentencing court so the court can consider the appropriateness of the sentence. And that is, if this court were to apply issue preclusion and claim preclusion, that is exactly what occurred in this case. The sentencing court, after the first revocation, did in fact consider the violations of law in Kansas. And just to address Justice Martinez's question a little bit.
I'm sorry, could you just finish that point?
Sure.
How did the court consider it? Did the defendant concede that he had committed those violations?
The defendant did not concede, but he did not argue that he had not committed those offenses. What the defense did was object to the prosecution being able to allege the facts of the Kansas violations. But the district court overruled that objection, allowed the prosecution to discuss the facts of the Kansas violations at length, and then the court stated that it was disappointed to hear about that there were drugs involved again, and that Mr. Lewis had gone to Kansas, and then increased the sentence. So,
was this a drug court case?
No, it was a felony possession of a controlled substance, so I believe it was in district court.
Mm-hmm.
And as to Justice Martinez's point, I think that conceiving of it as the probation starting in September 2004 when Mr. Lewis was placed on supervised probation, it would be true that issue preclusion and claim preclusion wouldn't apply, and I think that furthers the purposes of probation to not violate someone for conduct that occurred before they were on probation. Thank you very much.
On behalf of the court, I thank both counsel for your arguments. The case stands.